We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name's Nelson, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date, my last sobriety date, is December 17, 2010. I do have a home group. It's the Keep It Simple group in Elizabeth, Colorado. That's a small rural town southeast of Denver. I have two sponsors. One's George K. He was my first sponsor who walked me through the 12 steps when I first entered the rooms of AA. He's still my sponsor. He moved away. We're good friends. We stay in touch. But recently, I asked another George, George D., to be my sponsor because I felt the need to go through the steps again. As we live life and life comes along, sometimes we need a time to revisit the steps that we went through when we first came into the rooms of AA, and that is what I'm doing now with George D., and I'm very grateful for that. I'd like people to know that I speak for myself. I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. In my experiences with God, my higher power are mine and mine alone. And I'm not speaking of that to try and influence anyone. As it relates to how they view their higher power, I know from being in the rooms for many years, there are all types of feelings about God. Some people come in with a very close relationship with God, and some people come in with a very angry and hated relationship with God, and that we all have our own path. So as I share my story, that's just my story. I've lived with the physical and spiritual and neurological and disease of alcoholism, I think, my whole life. I'm one that believes I was born an alcoholic. We do have alcoholism in our family, but it doesn't run rampant. And I'll touch on that a little bit later. But from the first time I drank, I never, ever drank normally, which I'll go into a little bit more detail later. So my story of alcoholism, the consequences of my alcoholism, my recovery, how it happened, is one I'm glad to share, and thank you for inviting me on this to share. I'm an old guy. I'm 71 years old. I was born in 1952 in the southern town of Virginia. And as I look back on it, I feel blessed to have been living at a time when it was safe to just get on your bike and ride all day and be home in time for dinner, and nobody worried about you. It was a special time in America, I think, the 50s and early 60s. And that's when I was a kid growing up, and I had no trauma. I had nothing terrible happen to me in the family. I had a loving father, a loving mother. I have a wonderful brother who's 3 years older than me and a lovely sister who's 3 years younger than me. So I'm the middle child, the one who doesn't like conflict. We've always been close. They live in a different state than I do, but we stay in touch all the time and get together when we can. So I can't look back on my childhood as any reason why I would pick up the drink and drink the way I did. But I think I was probably 13, 14 years old, somewhere in there. Can't actually tell you exactly when, but it was about that time. And I don't know whose bourbon we stole, whether it was my parents or the friend I was with. Well, we had some bourbon, and we went underneath the tree. We had this great ravine behind my house, a place we used to play all the time, and big trees. And we went under this tree and drank this bourbon. And I got so sick, so drunk, that I literally would almost throw up for the next 10 years if I smelled bourbon. I could not drink bourbon. I didn't want to be around it. I got that sick. So I guess aversion therapy works pretty well on a 14-year-old. But I was ready to drink again. And from that point on, of course, when you're 14, you don't have access to a lot of alcohol unless you steal it from your parents or one of your friends steals it from their parents. But we somehow would get drunk on a fairly regular basis. And I think maybe once a month or something, two or three of us would go out, get whatever we got and drink. And I can remember one time running around in circles because we thought it would get into our blood system quicker. So we weren't drinking for the taste. We were drinking for the effect. And I think the reason I drank for the effect is what so many of us who walk into the rooms of AA have. I had an intense inferiority complex. I was totally insecure. I felt like I was invisible to my friends, like nobody even knew I was there. I'm sure this isn't true, but this is how I felt when the games were being picked on the schoolyard and, you know, you're picking a basketball or a football team or whatever. And there's several of us standing around and one guy's picking for one, his team, and the other guy's picking for his team. And he used to pray, God, please, God, don't let me be the last one picked. Because that meant I was the last one. Okay, Nelson, you can come on over here. And probably most of the time it didn't happen that way, but that's the way I felt. Totally insecure. I did pretty well in school. Matter of fact, one parent would ask me to tutor my good friend who wasn't doing too well in school, and I would do that. Turns out he ended up being an airline pilot for a major airline, so he did okay. But I just felt so insecure. I can remember looking out the window and seeing kids playing in the yard, and I was just afraid to even go out there. That didn't happen all the time, but it happened enough. So as I started to drink, you know, you start to find with guys that want to drink like you. And there was two or three of them. And that went on like that for a while. And when I was 15, we moved away from that town and moved to a town, Williamsburg, Virginia, which is an old colonial town, big tourist town where the townspeople dress up like in Franklin and Betsy Ross, and it's turned into quite a big town now. But when we moved there, it was a smaller town. It was a great town to grow up. And I was starting my junior year at York High and in Yorktown. And I got to say, those 2 years of high school were the most fun, because at that point I realized my parents really weren't all that much in control of me. They still had control, but I had a lot of freedom. And when I had that freedom, I used it to get drunk. You find the guys that drink like you. And I did. And we did. And we would actually say, let's go find somebody to buy some booze for us and we'll go get drunk. That was our goal. And we accomplished it. And of course, with that came a lot of consequences from drinking like that. And it's, you know, I can remember being brought home by the police. I was taken to the jail a couple of times, and it was just for being drunk. It wasn't for doing anything really bad. It was just being teenage boys getting drunk and doing all the stupid stuff we did. And it got so bad that my dad took me to, he had me go to a psychologist because they said, he must have said something's wrong with this boy. And it was. It was who I was. It's how I felt about myself. And when I drank, I was tall. You see, in my family, my sister's 5'10". Mom's 5'11", my dad and my brother are 6 foot, and I'm 5'6". And so that was part of my insecurity. So as a teenager, I started to buff out. I started lifting weights to kind of make up for that. I'd get drunk and I'd want to pick a fight. Here's a little 5'6" guy, drunk, trying to pick a fight with somebody that's 6 foot or taller. Only because when I drank, all of a sudden, I was Brad Pitt. I could take on the world. Fortunately, most of the time, I was just buffing in and never really ended up in any fights because I wasn't really a fighter. I really wanted to drink and chase girls. It was all about romance and getting drunk. And that led to a lot of problems. So I'm not unlike most people that come into AA. I was insecure. And when I drank, all of a sudden, I was 6 foot. I was strong. I was an athlete. I never was really good. I played a little football, but I wasn't very good. It just changed who I was, and I loved it. And so I can remember my dad sitting in my bedroom one time talking to me about my drinking problems. And I said something to the effect, "But you don't understand, Dad. I got a reputation of being the drunk in high school. And that was the first time in my life I had a reputation for anything. And I held on to it like a badge of honor. How foolish was I?" But I didn't know that. If my dad would have said, "You know, Nelson, I think you're an alcoholic. And if you don't stop drinking, all these bad things are going to happen in your life. And let me tell you what they are." I don't think I would have listened. Because I finally had an identity. Because when I drank, I was wild. I was a wild man. And people laughed at me and they thought I was crazy. I had people paying attention to me. So alcohol was my buddy. You know, I could do that. And back in Virginia in those days, you couldn't, the only place to buy hard liquor was at what they called the ABC store, Alcohol Beverage and Control Store. And there were usually a bunch of guys, you know, a bunch of winos hanging out in front of the store. And we would give them $5 or $10 or whatever it was to go in and buy us a bottle of whatever, what kind of rum or whatever we were drinking. And they go do it and they bring it out and we, you know, give them $1 or $2. That's how we got our booze. So anyway, through high school, that's what it was. So then somehow I got through high school. I was drinking, but at the tail end of high school, I was introduced to drugs, and that became a very significant part of my try to change who I was. I did a lot of the drugs, and I'm not going to go into it because really alcohol was my drug of choice. And for a few years, I was very involved with other drugs, but I was always, always involved with alcohol. So I somehow got into college and went to, it took me 4 colleges to get through. So I was restless, irritable, and discontent, as the doctor's opinion says in the big book. I was always restless. I went to 4 different colleges because that one's going to be better. And I would start again. You know, I had a pretty good college career. I did average. I, you know, got a degree in geology. And but when I was in college, it was just, you go to college to, honestly, to stay out of Vietnam, because Vietnam was raging at that time. And they were taking about the first 150. It was a lottery where they put your birthday on a little ping pong ball and threw it into a big lottery spin. And they'd pull the ball out and they'd read the date. And if that date was your birthday and you were within 150, you were told immediately to go down to the recruiting center and get ready to go into the Army and head over to Vietnam. And I didn't really want to go, but, you know, I didn't have any choice as to when they pulled the ping pong ball. And so my date ended up being like 323. I remember that to this day. So I knew I wasn't going to have to go to Vietnam. So I was in college and I was drinking and chasing girls and doing enough to get reasonable grades. But man, did I have consequences. I ended up in jail again. I ended up crashing a couple of cars, told them, I'm so grateful. No one ever got hurt. And it wasn't because of anything I did. It was just, I was lucky that no one ever got hurt. Really bad wrecks. So I'm getting ready to graduate from college, get a degree in geology, go off and be a geologist. I was living in a farmhouse like a lot of college kids do with other guys. And a couple of guys would, they made a little money doing things that were illegal. So they took a little trip down to Jamaica and brought some pot back. And unknown to me, they put it in my suitcase at this farmhouse. It was down in this kind of a dirt basement. And it's 3 days before graduation. I'm sitting on the couch with my girlfriend and bam, all of a sudden, agents are almost flying through the windows. They're coming in through every door and there's half a dozen or more of them. And they scream at me with their guns pulled and my girlfriend and pulse getting on the ground. And we did. And they said, "What's your name?" And I told them my name. And they said, "Well, you're not on this list. Who are you?" And I said, "Well, I live here." "Oh, we're not looking for you, but turn around. We're going to handcuff you anyway." So it turns out that they had gone to Jamaica, bought a bunch of pot, came back, put it in my suitcase down in the basement, and someone turned them in. So all of a sudden, 3 days before graduation, I'm sitting in jail because of this. Now, I wasn't an innocent kid. I mean, I certainly partook of enough pot myself, but I didn't have anything to do with this. But anyway, long story short, that's what my life was like. Just walking on the edge, you know, running with the people I shouldn't be running with. But they were running with me, and they shouldn't have been running with me, too. So I ended up getting out of that. And, you know, it was just kind of a, because I wasn't on the list. I never really, and nothing ever really happened. And my roommates ended up going to prison because you used to go to prison back in those days for pot. So anyway, I'm free. So I head out west to be a geologist. Then I go out west, and I didn't have a clue what I was going to do. But one way or the other, I ended up in the Wildcat oil fields, these big drilling rigs of Wyoming. And I was a grunt geologist, and I would work on these rigs way out in the middle of nowhere. And it was a perfect job for an alcoholic because everybody drank, even on these drilling rigs. We just drank and did drugs the whole time. And in these little towns where we lived, in these little Western towns, there might be three or four churches, but there'd be seven or eight bars. And there wasn't a whole lot to do. So, you know, you work on these rigs 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and then you go and you drink. And I did that to an extreme. Didn't save any money, made a lot of money. Eventually started my own little oil field service company with a partner. And then in 1978, I met this cute little gal who was a bartender at one of these bars in this little remote town of Afton, Wyoming. And she was cute. And somehow I must have lied to her enough that we got together. And within a few months, we're married. Now, here I was, a Southern boy from back east. And she was a Wyoming cowgirl. And no one thought that this thing would last. But May 19th, we'll have 45 years together. And I'm blessed that she stuck with me through all those years. So we get married. Now, her dad and mom own a fishing cabin, cafe, and bar just outside of Jackson, Wyoming, 10 acres, nice little business, and it was a bar. And I thought, well, how cool is this? So all of a sudden, my in-laws own a bar, and I'm running a small oil field company, and life is good, and I am drinking and snorting anything that comes my way. And I mean, we drank. And my wife kept up with me. And I think she just kept up with me because that's sometimes what spouses do. They try to keep up with the alcoholic. And I drank hard for 3 years running that company and doing all the stuff and running all over the state of Wyoming and Colorado and Utah on these drilling rigs. And it was getting bad. It was real bad. I was 28 years old. And I just couldn't control my drinking. And I was drinking everything. And it got to a point where we were drinking with one of our friends, probably doing some other things too. And he was all blue because his wife was cutting around on him, I think. And we're over at his house. And my wife and I are in there. And we're just drinking like we always do. And he walks away. And all of a sudden we hear, bang. And I look at my wife. I go, oh, no. I go back there. And sure enough, he'd shot himself. Fortunately, he was a bad shot. And he didn't kill himself, but he did end up in the hospital. So I call the police, and of course they come, and I'm trying to clean up all the illegal stuff, and there's, you know, of course, alcohol everywhere. But that's how he lived. Fortunately, my friend did live, but it was just a crazy life. Just hung over and drunk all the time, but working. I don't know how we did it. Anyway, I'm 28 years old. And where we were living was in a western town called Evanston, Wyoming. And it was right on the southwest edge of Wyoming, right next to Utah. So there's a lot of Latter-day Saint Mormon folk living there. Some of them obviously were in the oil fields, and I knew several of them, and one of them I knew quite well. His name was Dick. Good guy. He didn't drink, didn't smoke, just a good guy. Lived a clean life. I didn't hang around with him, but I knew him. So I wake up one morning, like I did every morning, sure hungover. I roll over and I look at my wife and I say, "I'm gonna call Dick. There's this rehab center in Utah down in Salt Lake City. It's an hour and a half drive from here. And I'm going to have Dick drive me down there." And I know she must have looked at me like, "Where is this coming from? Because no one ever said, Nelson, you need to quit drinking." Not my wife, not other people, at least to my knowledge. And here I am rolling over telling her this. So I call Dick. I say, "Dick, come take me down to Raleigh Hills." He says, "I'll be there in just a few minutes." So he showed up. I grab a handle of something. I don't know what it was. It could have been Crown Royal. Could have been vodka. I have no idea. But I grabbed a full bottle of it. And I'm drinking this bottle all the way down to Salt Lake City, to Raleigh Hills. Now, Raleigh Hills back in the day was one of these rehab centers that it didn't have anything to do with AA, unfortunately. It was called aversion therapy. So anyway, I check into Raleigh Hills, and the next day, I guess, when I'm sobered up, they walk into my room, and they say, "Mr. Brunow, your insurance, you haven't had it long enough, and if you come back in 2 months, they'll cover it. But if you stay today, you won't be covered." And I said, "How much is it?" They said, "It's $8,000 for 2 weeks." I said, "I don't care. I'm not leaving." That's how desperate I was. So I stayed, I paid the $8,000, and for 2 weeks, they did biofeedback. Their main theory was, "We're going to set you in a bar environment with the mirrors in the back and all the bottles against that, and we're going to give you something to take." And I took something, and I don't even know what it was. It might have been Anabuse or something else. But then they proceeded to make me drink all this alcohol, and I would just ugly, but I just throw up everywhere. And that was their process, aversion therapy, nothing to do with AA. So for 2 weeks, I'm doing this. I'm doing biofeedback. I'm throwing up everywhere. And, you know, the goal is to make me so I never want to walk into a bar and smell alcohol again. So 2 weeks later, they kick me out and they say, "Come back anytime you want." And of course, a few months later, they're bought out by another company. So I never go back. There's no follow-up. There's no discussion on the disease, the obsession once you drink. There was nothing about that. Well, my wife came and picked me up, and I go back to Wyoming and back to my work. And about a week or two later, we find out that my wife is pregnant with her first child. That's 6 weeks. And to this day, I know it was God. It rolled me over. It said, "You know, he's going to raise a child up in this world like that." And for the next 20 years, there wasn't a drop of alcohol or a drug in our house. And we had our first child about 7 months later. That's my first God experience, my first God awakening. So, I'm not drinking now. It's not AA, but I'm not drinking. I'm still working in the oil fields and still as crazy a world as it always was. But we got involved with a network marketing company back then, shortly thereafter, and got involved with it to make money, even though I was running my own little business. And it turns out this group, they didn't drink. And they'd hold these big conventions, and nobody would drink. And bartenders, you'd walk past the bartenders, they were twiddling their thumbs because they had, you know, here's several hundred people in this hotel and nobody was drinking. So all of a sudden I had this whole new support group around me, and I didn't even have to try and leave my old friends. I just had a whole new support group. It was based around this little business. I never really did much with the business, but stayed with it for about 3 years, and they kept me, gave me a whole new set of friends, which when we come into the program, we say, you really shouldn't hang around with your old friends, because that isn't good. And I had this wonderful blessing that came into my life that just kept me away from those people that I used to hang around with. And so for, you know, two, three, 4 years, I didn't drink. I was on the road a fair amount, working in the oil fields, but I didn't drink. But then somewhere along the way, one night, I was in Rawlins, Wyoming. I remember this. A really windblown town in southern Wyoming. They didn't have very nice hotels, so you usually stayed in these cheap hotels. And I think maybe I wasn't sleeping or something. I said, well, you know what? I'm going to get up and go buy a couple of beers, and that might help me go to sleep. It was that innocent. That simple. I never knew anything about the obsession. I never knew anything about the first drink. I just hadn't drank in 4 years, didn't have any support, didn't have any follow-up, didn't have any program. So why wouldn't I drink? I didn't think there was anything to it. Well, from that point on, I started drinking on the road. I never drank at home. No one ever knew I drank on the road. My kids grew up never seeing me drink, ever, until I took another position. I became VP of global sales for a couple of IT Silicon Valley kind of companies. That was a long story. I won't go into that, but I'm traveling the world. I'm still drinking on the road, but I'm not drinking a lot. You know, I drink, but I don't drink a lot. And I don't know why, because we've got a progressive disease. Sometimes I would drink a lot, but it wasn't all the time. And then I decided to leave that world and start my own company, move my family out to Colorado. 1999, I started a company from scratch. And it was probably within a year, we're sitting at a Joe's Crab Shack in Aurora, Colorado, with my family. My oldest son's probably about 16, 17. So David would have been about 14, most about, 11 or so. I order a beer. Now, understand, they hadn't seen me for 20 years drink anything. And I order a beer. And they just kind of look at me and I say, I'm almost 50 years old. I think I can have a beer. And I drank that beer and I think I might have ordered one too, my wife. I don't remember. But then I was off to the races. I was about 50 years old. And for the next 8 years, hell broke loose. I started drinking more and more and more. But I wasn't a bar drinker at that time because I was past that point. I was 50s and I was drinking at home. I'd get a bottle, I'd come home. I was running a business, so I had plenty of excuses to drink, right? If my employees only respected me more, if my wife only loved me more, if my kids only did what I say, all those excuses that don't have anything to do with our alcoholism. I'd come home and gin became my drink of choice, and then pour a glass, and then pour another glass, and then pour another glass. And I look over, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, there's just a little bit left in the fifth. And that was my life. If you looked at our life from the outside, I had a nice home, a beautiful family. They still love me. I mean, we were going to church sometimes. Had a small business. Things looked good from the outside. But when I drank, I would walk outside sometimes and look up at the stars and say, does everybody think about killing themselves two or three times a week? Because I did. I did. The depression was so heavy. I can remember waking up in the morning sometime. I ran a small business, so I didn't have anybody to call into and say, hey, boss, I'm sick today. I had to go anyway. And I was in professional sales. We covered the 13 Western states. I had sales guys scattered all over the Western U.S. And I got so depressed in the morning. I just wanted to bring those covers over my head and not face the day. And I know there's a lot of people that have my disease that felt the same way. But you still have to get up. And I'd have to get up and I'd go to the office and I'd put on a smile. And I felt terrible. I had the sweats. My head was splitting. I was sweating like crazy. Sometimes I go into business meetings in a business environment and I'm sweating like I'm in a sauna. And I got a towel in the back of my head just wiping the sweat away. That was my life. That's how I was living. I didn't drink every night. And I didn't always drink to be drunk. I always just wanted one more. my wife, Kim, God bless her, she'd say, why don't you just have two tonight? I said, yeah, I think I'll try. I'll just have two. And then I'd have two, but I'm just going to have one more, just one more. And after that, just one more. And then she's off to bed, and it's just one more and one more and one more. That's because I can't control it. I'm an alcoholic. I have no control. Now, I didn't get drunk every time I drank, but if I didn't have any reason not to get drunk, I would get drunk. If I was in a business environment, I could drink two or three. I'd usually have a bottle up in the room if I was on the road, and I could control that situation, but I wanted more. If I drank one or two, I wanted more. But if I was in a business environment, I can hold off. And then I'd go upstairs to my room, finish off whatever was up there. So that's my life. God saved me. And I forgot about that. I want to tell you another little sidebar to this is I was addicted to cigarettes from the age of 15. I tried quitting in my 20s many, many, many times. Couldn't. Just couldn't. That business group I was telling you about, they had these conventions about every 3 or 4 months. And they were in nice hotels. So I'm at one of these conventions with my wife. And it's the type of bedroom that had a really nice bathroom off to the side and had a vanity and all that kind of stuff. And I'm in there. And this apparition is right before me. Now, at the time, I would have called that apparition Jesus. I don't know if it was or not, but it was real. It wasn't solid, but it was an apparition that was visible, so visible to me. And it didn't talk to me in its mouth, but I heard this voice. Why are you destroying my temple? And then the apparition just kind of dissolved. And I walked out of that bathroom. I looked at my wife. She was on the bed. I said, I think Jesus just told me not to destroy his temple, meaning my body. I took that pack of cigarettes. I threw them away. This is the truth. I never had one withdrawal. None. Zero. Zip. From that point on. That was a God moment. That was a God awakening. And a year later, I pick up a cigarette. I steal a cigarette from a coworker. Their pack of cigarettes is on the desk, and I steal one of her cigarettes. And I run off into the bathroom and smoke it like some kid in high school. Turn on the fan because I didn't want anybody to know I was smoking. From that point on, I was hooked. That's the addictive body I've got. Give me one, and I'm hooked. And I smoked for I guess I was about 28 when that happened. And so for the next 28 years, I smoked. And I would buy a pack of cigarettes, take one, throw them. I tried to quit. But I couldn't quit cigarettes, just like I couldn't quit booze. I was 2 weeks in December out in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was covering for one of my employees. We were a sales organization. I was out there covering for them, living in a hotel, drinking every night, wine, gin, waking up every morning sick, hungover. 2 weeks. Well, the day I'm supposed to leave, I fly out of San Francisco Airport. There's a great little seafood restaurant there called Scott's. And I'm hungover as can be. I've been drinking every night for 2 weeks. Anyway, I'm in this restaurant. I'm ordering my meal, and I order one beer. Now, that's December 16th. I fly home. We were supposed to go to a party at some friend's house on the 17th. And they drank. They weren't a bunch of alcoholics, but they drank. I came home and I said, honey, I'm not going to that party. I looked up a meeting and I'm going to a meeting in Casa Rosa, an AA meeting, 7 o'clock. And she once again kind of looked at me like, okay, where is this coming from? And she said, okay, well, I guess you can go to your meeting with alcoholics and I'm going to go to mine with alcoholics. And we kind of chuckled over that. And this that night, it was a cold, actually it was the next night. I quit drinking on the 17th. The next night was the night of the meeting. It was a cold, cold, cold Colorado night. I mean, stars bright. Because when stars are bright, it can get really cold. I pull up to this old, it was, a Mason's building. And it had the old style windows in there, and they were amber and everything. You know, you see that amber light at 7 o'clock at night, and it just looks so warm and inviting. But I'm sitting in my truck. I got there like 15 minutes early. I'm just sitting there. And eventually, I knew it was supposed to start at 7. So I ramble up to the front door and open this big old wooden door. And it kind of goes, and I walk in. It has those old wooden floors. And I look into the back. And there's a guy making coffee back in the kitchen area. And he turns around. He looks at me. And he comes walking up. And he sticks his hand out. He says, welcome. You're in the right place. I went in. And I never left. I sat around that table. And I listened to my story as these people were sharing in that 1 hour. This person and this person and this person and this person. I drink like that. I feel like that. That's happened to me. And it only lasted an hour. And I walk out and I get in my truck. And I'm driving out of Castle Rock up the hill back towards Elizabeth. And all of a sudden it hits me. Oh my God. They're talking about never drinking again. They're talking about never drinking again. But I was back the next night and the next night and the next day. And I just kept going to meetings. Second meeting I went to, I didn't know anybody, obviously. And at the end of the meeting, they said, if you want books, we got books up here for sale. And I ran up to the guy. I said, I want the book. He said, okay, it's $9. And I whipped a 20 out. And he says, well, I don't have change. I said, I don't care. Here's 20. I want the book. And I ran home and I started reading that book. And I read the doctor's opinion. Dr. Silkworth said, we're restless, irritable, and discontent. And I said, oh my God, that's my life. That's how I lived my life. I'm 58 years old. That same night I bought the book, I ran up to the guy that was chairing. I said, will you be my sponsor? I hear that you're supposed to get a sponsor. He looked at me and goes, no. What am I supposed to do now? He said, but I know somebody who will. And he gave me my first sponsor, George K. He said, call this guy. And I called George. And it turns out George had only been sober about a year. But George walked me through the steps. George became such a good friend. He took me in and took me to the meetings and started to show me how my thinking was wrong. All the consequences in my life. You know, I didn't make bad decisions every time I drank, but I can look back and say most of the bad decisions I made, I was drinking. So that's how I came into the halls of AA. God's led me here. No question about it. And I've had other God moments that I won't go into, but you see, I came into this not opposed to God, not hating God, not afraid of God. As a matter of fact, at some point in my life, I was very close to a spiritual God. But as I started to drink, I got further and further and further and further away. But I have one now. And today, my God is much bigger. And this is who my God is. I don't know who your God is. But my God is love. And forgiveness. That's how I try and live my life. Thank you, Tara, for letting me share. I'm Nelson, alcoholic.
Thank you, Nelson. Thank you for your story. your wife seemed still surprised in 2010 when you told her you were going to an AA meeting. Does she think you're an alcoholic?
She knew I was an alcoholic. There was no question I was an alcoholic. But I had no one telling me to do anything about it.
Well, happy anniversary to you guys. 45 years coming up on 45 years. That's amazing and sweet story.
I have to say this too, Tara, and I did leave this out. I have three beautiful children. And I'm telling you, this is a genetic disease. And one of them is in this program. After struggling 10 years, he's got 2 years, and he is an amazing young man. And it is a genetic and a family trait, but I'm so grateful that he is, you know, he finally surrendered and understood that when you're an alcoholic, you never will control it.
You had mentioned early on that you were born an alcoholic, and that it runs lightly in your family, and you would touch upon that later. Is that what you're referring to as your son?
Well, that, and believe it or not, my mother was an alcoholic, but I never really recognized that until she passed in 2006, because she never was falling down on the floor. She never was passed out on the couch when we came home, but she drank a lot of beer. And after she passed, and I had two beautiful parents, after she passed, I asked my sister, "Do you think Mom was an alcoholic?" And my sister responded, "Duh." It just never connected. So, and her father was an alcoholic who ultimately ended up taking his life when he was older. And then so we do have some alcoholism. It's not like I've heard some families where it's like everybody's an alcoholic, but I do believe it's genetic. And I never drank normally. I never drank normally. And so that's why I say I was born alcoholic.
You said also fairly early on that you drink for effect. And my reaction is, why else would anybody drink? Why else would you drink if it wasn't for the effect? But that's because I'm an alcoholic, and it's, one never made sense. Two doesn't even really make sense. Like, go big or go home when it comes to alcohol.
Go big or go home. There's so much to relate after drinking for 45 years off and on. But I can tell you, life is good on this side of the river, Tara. Life is good on the sober side of the river. And I could go on and on about the benefits of being sober, the blessings, how you feel, how you think, how you live your life, how you can contribute in a more positive way to those people around you. But you know that. You've experienced it. It's just, you learn how to be a different person. Someone once told me, you know, when you become sober and live that way through the AA way of life, you live the way God made you. That's how God wants you to be. Not the twisted, the tormented, the angry, the resentful, the self-pity person you were when you were steeped in your alcoholism and drinking. But God wants you to live a life where you're useful to others and can be productive and help and care about and be there for others. You know, someone in my group says this frequently. She says, when I was drinking, I wasn't all bad and it wasn't all good. And now that I'm sober, I'm not all good and I'm not all bad, but I'm a lot better.
You mentioned George D. and wanting to go through the steps again. And you alluded to something going on in your life but did not elaborate. Was there something specific that occurred that got you there?
it's a family thing. And it's to help me live a life of forgiveness and love. And it's relating to family. And I really want to grow in that area with this particular situation. I want to have nothing but compassion and forgiveness and love. And that's what I'm working on.
That's how you described your God, too, as love and forgiveness. So, in his likeness.
That's what I hold on to. I'll tell you one quick story. My dad was dying of blood cancer. He passed in 2002. In 2001, we're sitting on the center room back in Virginia visiting. And somehow the subject came up. He said, you know, Nelson, I'm not afraid of death because I died before. And I sat there and thought to myself, oh, I must not have been at dinner that night when you mentioned that to the family. And I said, Dad, what are you talking about? And I remember when this happened, I was living in Wyoming, but I remember when this event happened, my mom and my dad went back to Southwest Virginia for sort of a family reunion. Mom had taken a really bad spill, ended up in the emergency room, and my father died while she was in the emergency room in the hospital. And he said, they went to work on me. He said, I saw my body. I saw everything in that room. And I felt nothing but love and peace. And I wish I could have just recorded everything he said. Now, this coming from my father, he served in the Pacific during World War II and saw some of the most horrific things. And he was one that was not a super spiritual guy. We went to church and that was about it. So he was like his feet were on the ground. And when he related his experience of being dead and then being brought back into his body, that was so unlike my father that I started researching that phenomenon. And what I have found through the research, and I'm not saying this is true, it's just what I've found from what I've read and what I've listened to. When we cross that veil, they are enveloped in love and forgiveness. Love, indescribable, and forgiveness. And that's kind of what my dad described to me. And so that's part of why I feel the way I do, Terry.
Well, that's a really powerful story. I don't know how to pivot from that to anything less than serious. So it sounds like he had a near-death experience and uncharacteristically shared it with you.
That's exactly right. He was not one that would share something like that unless it happened. And so he told me, he says, Nelson, I'm not afraid of death anymore. I just want to know where I am in the process as I'm dying. And that's all he wanted to know. Mm-hmm. And so.
Is there anything that you left out of your story or anything that you're thinking of now that you would like to share?
For the one who is struggling, that may be listening to this, you don't have to understand it all. Just trust the process. We have a program where you never have to go back to where you were before you came into these rooms or before you listened to this. It's good on this side of the river. We're happy. We're content. We're useful. And it's waiting here for you. Just trust the process. Come to meetings. Get a sponsor. Work the steps. And you can have a good life. And I hope you will try.
Well, you just answered my final question in my second to last question, Nelson. All right. I'm going to ask for one final story then. Do you have more time?
I do.
Okay. You talked about two God moments when you woke up and turned over to your wife and off you went to aversion therapy, which sounds terrible. And then you talked about when you were in the hotel and some image of some sort that you describe as understanding to be Jesus told you about hurting your temple, destroying your temple. And you had said that you had other stories of, about these God moments or these God shots or these synchronicity, insert whatever makes sense to you, listener. Can you tell us one more story?
Sure. This was after I'd gotten sober. It was within probably a year of the first time I got sober, 28 in 1982. We lived in this little western town called Evanston, Wyoming, and it was a small little oil field town. It was a boom town at the time, but I just had this feeling to stop into this little church there in Evanston, and there had this parsonage, and it was just almost a broken down little old wooden structure, you know? I just went in there to maybe see if somebody could tell me when, you know, they hit church or something. I don't remember exactly why I stopped in front of that church and walked in that old windblown parsonage. But I did. And it turns out this young pastor was in there. We were about the same age. He was maybe a little older than me. And I don't remember how the conversation went. But this is just a true story of what happened to me. He said, "Are you saved?" And I said something to the effect of, "Well, what do you mean? I don't know what you mean." He says, "Have you accepted Jesus?" And I said, "Well, you know, I grew up in church and I went to Sunday school." And he says, "No, that's not what I mean." He says, "Have you accepted Jesus as your Savior?" And I went, "Well, I think so. Maybe I got," he says, "Here, let me walk you through a couple of things." And we walked through a couple of things, and I said a prayer. And it sounds crazy, but all of a sudden, I am praying in a language that I'd never heard before. In this little Baptist church in Evanston, Wyoming. And I come out of there, and I literally feel like I'm walking 6 inches off the ground there. I'm just, this feeling is just amazing. And I think it was a feeling of forgiveness because I hadn't been a very good boy up to that point. And I drove across town, walked in the front door. At the time, my mother-in-law were living with us. I invited her to live with us because they had lost their place. And she lived with us for 25 years. And I walked in the front door. And I looked at my wife and my mother-in-law and I said, "I've just been saved," like out of the blue. And I said, "I just met God." Hmm. And my wife looked at me and said, "Well, why didn't you come get me?" I said, "Well, honey, it's hard for me to say, hey, God, hold on a minute. Let me drive across town, grab my wife, and I'll come back." And sure enough, within, you know, next time we were over there, she met with the pastor and had a similar experience, but it was very real, Tara. And I'm not sharing this to proselytize anybody. It's just what happened to me. And that was another one of my God moments. Grateful for it.
I appreciate you sharing it and sharing your story, your experience, strength, and hope.
Thank you for the opportunity.
My pleasure. My pleasure. For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.